This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Another quarter is coming to an end. It's a time when numbers crunchers gather to take stock of many things, including the performance of the economy. When times were good, we didn't spend much time on those numbers because they were always going up, up, up. And that was good, good, good. But the Great Recession changed that. Suddenly, those numbers hold great import. We all want to know when they might start going back up from the recent lengthy downturn. Earlier this week, national economists informed us that the Great Recession is over. In fact, they said it ended in July 2009, a year ago. But in North Carolina, at least, we're still feeling the pinch. So again, we turn to Dr. John Connaughton, the UNC Charlotte economist, who is director of the North Carolina Economic Forecast, for his opinion and his prognostications on the future. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
Summer vacation is over.
Yeah.
Let's get to work.
And not much has changed.
As I mentioned, that's not true, because as I mentioned, the Business Cycle Dating Committee, which sounds like Match.com or something, yeah. The Business Cycle Dating Committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research announced Monday that the recession ended in June or July of 2009. Was that news to you? Do you agree with that? And why haven't we felt it yet, if it's true?
Well, it wasn't really news. I think a number of us have been saying for over 2 years now that this thing will probably end in May or June of 2009. The NBER came out and confirmed it. What's interesting is they came out and confirmed it. Normally, it takes them about almost 2 years, and they did it in just a little over a year in terms of deciding when this thing ended. So they had to be fairly certain that it ended in, you know, the trough was hit in June of 2009.
And how do they determine that?
Well, basically, they look at a broad set of indicators.
Right.
But the big thing is that the third quarter GDP was up so significantly in 2009 that there's no way that you could assume that a recession continues on. The problem that we have, Mike, in any recession is that employment growth and unemployment rates lag the GDP. And so the GDP sends the signal that, you know, we're starting to produce more. We've stopped the decline in output. But it can take 6 or 9 months mm-hmm. before we start to see a break on the employment and unemployment side. And we did. I mean, in January, roughly 6 months later, we started to see employment go up nationally and in North Carolina. So by January of 2010, roughly 6 or 7 months later, employment growth started. The problem was, and this is what's got everybody kind of concerned, is that the employment growth, both nationally and locally, has not been as robust as we would have expected, or you would typically experience coming out of a recession.
And you said that surprised you. Before we went on the air, you said that the lag or the recovery not being as robust as you thought it was going to be was a surprise.
Yeah. First of all, I don't think anyone or the vast majority of economists expected it to be as robust as it was, say, in 91 recession or back in the 82 recession. We felt it was going to be more like coming out of the 2001 recession, and we did expect slower employment growth for a variety of reasons, which we can talk about later. But this is even slower than the slowness we expected, and I think that's really the issue here. In the first 8 months of the job expansion, so it started in January, and we got 8 months through August. Now, this is national number, and I'll give you the North Carolina number in a minute. If you look back at the three most recent recessions, the 2001, the 90, 91, and the 82 recession, when job growth began after that trough and expansion began, when the job growth started, at the end of 8 months, we had replaced between 40 and 50% of the jobs that had been lost in the recession. So typically 8 months out, mm-hmm. job growth, you've got back almost half, 40 to 50% of the jobs. We've only gotten back 9% of the jobs nationally.
And we're, we're 15 months.
No, we're 8 months into the job recovery, when okay. jobs started to expand. So at the same point in this recession versus the last three, the job growth has just been anemic compared to what you would have expected.
Why?
In North Carolina, the number is even worse. We're okay. below 5% in terms of the jobs that we got back.
So why? Why is it that?
There's
why,
a variety of reasons. And what we've experienced over the past several recessions is that job growth cycle has become longer. In other words, from the time you enter and you have the job peak and you go through a job decline the job decline hits a trough and then starts back up. And the time that it takes for it to reach the pre-recession level of employment has been lengthening. And in the most recent one back in 2001, it took 49 months, 4 years for that level to come back.
Do we know why?
We think that the biggest reason is that there's been a dramatic structural change in the economy. And second thing is that we've had phenomenal productivity increases that have seemed to be sustainable over the past dozen years.
Which means what? That fewer people are doing more work and they've been able to do it successfully for a long period of time, so we don't need those extra people?
That's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is that if you look at the productivity growth over the past decade, on average it's been a little bit better than 2%. If the economy grows at 2% and the labor force doesn't change, or you know, no new entrants in the labor force, basically you can do the same amount of output. You can match that 2% growth in output with the same level of workers, same number of workers. So you don't have to add workers to do that. And that's not historically been the case. So the second thing is that when we had much higher percentage of our labor force involved in manufacturing, okay, manufacturing was, you know, very simply, it was a fixed coefficient production function, and that is, if you wanted to make another car, you had to add so much more capital and so many more workers. There was no way around it. And today, with lower percentage of our labor force in manufacturing and more people in services, those types of production functions don't exist anymore.
But if you want your company,
employers can be more flexible in terms of increasing output.
But if you want, if growth is 2% and you want growth to be at 4% or 8%, and you want to make more money in your company, to overcome this 2% that you're getting by with the same number of workers,
mm-hmm.
don't you need to hire people?
Well, again, you look at...
If you want to sell more, you got to have people able to buy
more. Think about the average business person that has to make these decisions. And they're looking at the same numbers that we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll ask you a real simple question. Do you expect in the next 6 months growth to be better than 2 or 3% in GDP? And I suspect the answer you're going to tell me is not really.
Well,
no.
To be honest, I don't think much about it, but okay, no.
No. All right. If I don't think there's going to be much more than a 2% growth rate, then I'm not inclined to expand production to meet an expectation of growth mm-hmm. that I don't really see.
Well, has this been exacerbated by the fact that more and more companies have gone to on-demand supply? In other words, they don't stockpile large inventories. They make it when the demand comes in.
Right. And that's the second issue, and that is, you know, so much better inventory control systems that we have today, or logistics, supply chain, whatever term you want to use. And as a result of that, they can monitor their production a lot tighter than they have been able to in the past, whether it's a manufacturing or a distribution operation or even services. I mean, it's just they're a lot more efficient, and what that simply means is they don't need to hire people in expectation of something happening 6 months down the road. Again, the normal way that a business person would look at this thing is, well, if I expect the economy to be really great 6 months from now, and I don't anticipate that, and I don't hire and get my production capacity ramped up a little bit, I'm going to miss sales down the road, and I'm going to miss profit down the road. They just don't think that way right now. They don't think that consumers are going to change, and we really, you know, we can talk about what's going on in terms of causing a lot of this anemic growth, but consumers are one big part of it. It's this concept of the new normal, where people are making conscious decisions to live with less.
Well, let's talk about the new normal for a second. Do we need – we have adjusted some of our expectations. We are living with less. We're not spending as much as we used to spend. We are saving more, which is causing us not to recover quite as quickly. If we were to stop saving and spend, then the recovery would speed up. But do we need, as Americans, to adjust our expectations about what recovery means for the future? Do we need to anticipate and accept a lower standard of living going forward?
That's an interesting question. I think not. Okay. I think that the United States has historically been a very healthy economy. There are a lot of systems in place and institutions in place which make this an economy that can sustain long-term economic growth and long-term per capita real economic growth as well. What's happened is that putting this, you call it the Great Recession, and I think that's the term that's sort of surfaced as what we're going to call this. It's not the Great Depression,
no,
but it's not like any other recession we've had in anyone's memory. And certainly since we've been keeping records where we actually have good GDP and employment number records, which has only been a mid-20th century invention, if you will, this has certainly been the most severe recession, no matter how you measure it, in terms of length, in terms of the drop, the depth, in terms of number of jobs lost, et cetera. It's really been a very, very most severe recession that we've experienced. But, and this is a big caveat, I guess, it's not like the Great Depression for a couple of reasons, and that is the Great Depression was really, we talked about double dip, it was really a triple dip. There were three cycles to it, if you will. And second thing is the Great Depression had tremendous deflation associated with it. And we've seen the Fed talk about their fear of deflation. Yeah. But as of this moment, we haven't experienced it. So this has really been a really tough recession, and it just grabs people and makes them think about, you know, how they should behave and how they should protect themselves. Yeah. And I think most people realize that a lot of people got caught in this and lost a lot. And going forward, most folks say, well, you know, there but for the grace of God go I maybe had gotten by. I didn't get hammered in this, but I got that close to being hammered. I need to put myself in a position where I'm protecting myself. And one way to do that is to not get in debt. And I think most people are looking at that. They're knocking their debt levels down considerably. We see that every month when the total of consumer debt goes down, which people paying things off and not engaging in new loans. And second thing is that they're just lowering their expectations, uh-huh. so they feel more comfortable with doing this protective strategy.
Well, that's a good thing individually, but is it a good thing when we all do it at the same time?
It's what we call, we talk to our principal students about the fallacy of composition. Uh-huh. You know, the old penny saved is a penny earned kind of a thing. You know, you're right, it's good for the individual, absolutely good for the individual to protect themselves. But when everyone does that, you're right, it lowers the potential growth.
So do you worry about a double-dip recession? If we came out of this recession July or June of last year, are we going back into one? Are we leveling out? Where are we?
Well, what's happened is we had a couple of robust quarters of growth in the third and fourth quarter of 2009. But since then, it's really kind of tapered off and slowed. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, North Carolina did not enjoy that third and fourth quarter growth. You know, the U.S. economy had six quarters of decline in GDP, all of 2008, first two quarters of 2009. But by the third quarter of 2009, it turned around nationally. North Carolina didn't turn around to the first quarter of 2010. So we actually experienced eight quarters in a row of GDP decline.
Okay, so we weren't late to the party and late coming out. We were on time with the party and lingered.
Yeah, and lingered. And we hung around for a couple extra months. And there are a couple of reasons for that. But the biggest thing is that we really didn't have real loss of GSP during that period of time. It was mostly flat in the third and fourth quarter. It was just slightly down, like 0.2%, kind of a very, very modestly down. But we didn't get the growth.
So I have like 30 seconds here, but are there signs to look for to determine whether or not we are in or entering a double-dip recession?
I think there are signs that you can look for, but we just don't see them. I think it's going to take another kind of external shock that would push us into a second dip. And the information in the real economy we're getting right now just doesn't seem to be indicating.
And you have said there's little likelihood of a double-dip recession in the second half of 2010, but the economy will continue to be sluggish enough that to many people it will feel like a return to recession.
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll come back and be talking more about that in a second. Dr. John Connaughton is with us, UNC Charlotte, and the director of the North Carolina Economic Forecast. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at KnightFoundation.org. And the U.S. National Whitewater Center, Whitewater River Jam, a summer concert series every Thursday and Saturday night. Live music, food, drinks, open to the public, usnwc.org/riverjam. Well, last week, the EPA held a public hearing here in Charlotte on proposed coal ash regulations, one of eight planned meetings nationwide. And the hearing brought into focus the topic of coal ash pollution and revealed many facets and points of view. So we'll take a closer look at those points of view and get an update on last week's hearings and bring you up to speed on the proposed regulations and their potential impact on the region when we get together tomorrow morning at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm show, salmon that grows twice as fast as conventionally farmed fish could become the first genetically modified animal approved for American consumption. The benefits, risks, and concerns over how the product might be labeled.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on 90.7 FM WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're in our Spirit Square studio today with Dr. John Connaughton, director of the UNC Charlotte North Carolina Economic Forecast, who said that there's little likelihood, as I repeat from the last segment, of a double-dip recession in the second half of the year, but the economy will continue to be sluggish to the point where many of us will feel like we're in a return to recession. Is that why in August nearly two-thirds of Americans said they believed the economy had yet to hit bottom?
Well, I think that people don't look at company profitability. They don't look at GDP growth because that doesn't directly affect them. I mean, those are really kind of abstract measures to most people. Most people, what they look at is where they're most vulnerable, and that's employment opportunities, job growth, and the unemployment rate. And so far, as we mentioned earlier, we haven't seen the job growth that we would expect at this point in time. Mm-hmm. Have we had job growth? Sure, we've added jobs. We've added 720-some thousand in the national economy after we lost 8.3 million. But that's a drop in the bucket. As I said, that's 9% of the jobs we've lost, we've added. So to the average citizen, it just doesn't feel like things are getting better.
Many people in Charlotte say, looking back on the beginnings of this, that it was like somebody, it didn't happen gradually. It was like somebody turned the spigot off 1 month in 2007 at the end of the year, and that was the end of it. That was the end of the good times. You just turned it off. Will we experience the recovery as somebody turning the spigot back on?
No, and I actually don't think that's quite how we got into this thing. I think there were really, there were two tipping points. As you mentioned, the recession officially began in January of 2008. So, mm-hmm. You know, the end of the good times was in 2007. We saw it coming, as we've talked about before. The Fed started initiating easing monetary policy in August of 2007, mm-hmm. because they saw the indicators there. But no one really expected what put us into that 2008 recession, which was energy prices in 2007. If you remember, gasoline was over $4 a gallon, and that has an effect on taking money out of consumer pockets. We didn't expect it to be that kind of really big recession. We expected to be more like 2001. The problem was the second shoe fell, that second external factor that really caused great difficulty, and that occurred in September of 2008, mm-hmm. 9 months into the recession, and it was a bigger impact. The first one was kind of this gradual grinding to, slowing down, kind of GDP dropping, but not terribly, unemployment starting to rise, job losses, et cetera. But then in September, when the financial crisis hit, it was like, and the credit markets just stopped working. It was like the rug was pulled out from under the economy. It was just a free fall for the next two quarters.
Well, a lot of this, it seems to me, is psychological. A lot of this reluctance to recover is psychological. People are scared to spend money because they don't know if there's going to be money coming in next month, mm-hmm. because the economy might get worse.
Absolutely.
Don't know. So if we are recovering, and you say we are, and other economists say that we are, why are we recovering? What is happening to move the recovery forward?
Well, companies are profitable, and we've adjusted to this new lower-level economy. It's not a big dip in terms of the level of output compared to where we were before, but it's not at the same level and not growing quite as fast. And companies have figured out how to be profitable and how to move ahead. And there is some modest increase in demand and output. Mm-hmm. So, we are having economic growth. It's just not the kind of growth, that we had been experiencing long-term since the last recession in 2001, and B, it's not the kind of growth that you'd expect coming out of recovery.
Would it be accurate to say that a lot of that growth was fueled by people leveraging themselves to points where they really couldn't afford it, but they thought they could because they thought the value of their home would always go up, up, up?
Yeah, using their house as an ATM machine.
Okay, and if that's the case, is it safe to say that we will never go back to that, at least not in the next 10, 20, 30 years?
Well, certainly not in the next 10 years, I would think. Yeah.
So can we recover?
There are rules in place that aren't going to let people take money out like
so
they used to.
So can we recover? Will we ever go back to what we experienced in 2006, 2007?
Yeah, not anytime soon. Not anytime that we'll remember that somebody said that.
And what will that look like to the average person? What will life be like? What will their spending capabilities be? What will their lives be like? What kind of expectations will they have going forward? What will they be buying or not buying?
It'll have to be based on their productivity. And, you know, that's just simply all there is to it. The problem is that productivity gains that individuals make are not going to be rewarded in an employment market, a labor market, with 9%, 9.5% unemployment. And so, you know, it's going to be what we've said, and we've tried to make this very, very clear to people, is that from the time that we started adding jobs in January of 2010, we really expected, instead of taking a year or 16 months to get back to where we get those 8.3 million jobs back, it was going to take 4 or 5 years to do that. And that's the kind of growth that we're looking at. We should be able to support enough economic growth over the next several years that it's going to take 4 or 5 years, roughly three times as long as you would expect to get the jobs back that we lost.
Some businesses have said that uncertainty is holding them back from hiring people. You've talked about this and from making business investments. What are they uncertain of? Are they uncertain of consumers buying, of changes in tax policy, of health care costs associated with this new health care legislation that has not kicked in yet? What are they uncertain of?
I think they're uncertain about all of those things, but I think that's really a straw man. I think that companies are using that, or a lot of folks are using that as an excuse for their own reluctance simply to feel comfortable investing and hiring. As we said earlier in the program, I think a lot of businesses simply look at the economic future. They don't really see economic growth. They don't see the probability that they could lose sales if they don't expand now. And so they're just being very, very cautious, like consumers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so at the same time, they're angry at some things politically that have taken place. And so they go ahead and use that as kind of an excuse. But I don't think that uncertainty, for example, about the cost that healthcare are going to impose on the company would be an impediment if people 6 months from now actually see output growth and sales potential. I think they'd go for that. Tap into that.
The lights are still on. The sun is still shining. It still rains occasionally.
It's still the world's largest economy.
So if nothing changed from this day forward, is the only downside of this whole thing at the moment, aside from lowered expectations and the reluctance to go out and buy big ticket items that we really can't afford, is the only downside the unemployment rate?
That's the major downside, certainly, because that's what affects people. And, you know, how long will people be comfortable going forward with this is a question. Now, as a result, and I think it's fairly clear, I don't think I'm any breaking news here, as a result of this kind of hanging on of the high unemployment rate and the fact we haven't had any jobs, there's going to be a big political change come November, simply because people are fed up with this situation. I mean, they're blaming the current party in Congress and in the White House. Whether that's true or not is a different question, but they're just using them as a scapegoat, if you will, and they're going to throw them out and put in new people.
Well, who is
but
to blame?
I don't think
this all started under George W. Bush. He put out that incentive package.
Mike, I don't think that George Bush or Barack Obama
have anything to do with it.
Well,
let's put it this way. Could a George Bush, were he still in office, and can a Barack Obama do anything about it to change it? Can they make things better?
I think that they've done as much as they possibly can, maybe more than they should have. I don't think that this is a situation that the president has a lot of control or Congress has a lot of control.
Because the president's being encouraged by Bill Clinton now to go to the voters in the next several weeks before the November election and say, look, we inherited a much of this mess. We've done a lot of things to try to turn it around. Some things are working. Some things aren't. What we need is more time. So here's the deal. What I want you to do is vote for the status quo, give us 2 more years, and if we don't solve this in 2 more years, kick us all out, including me. That's what Bill Clinton said last night. And I'm told, well, the prognosticators, the news analysts say, that President Obama is thinking seriously about that as a tactic. Is that a wise thing to do if he can't do anything more about this?
Mike, I've learned a long time ago that I'm an economist, not a political scientist.
Okay.
and I wouldn't know exactly whether that's a good idea or not. I will just say that.
No, but if you say that you really don't know that he can do anything more, that anybody could do anything more, is that a wise tactic to take?
Probably is, yeah.
All right. The Commerce Department announced on Thursday that nationally home construction increased last month, and applications for building permits also grew, driven mainly by apartment and condominium construction. Mm-hmm. Given that construction and housing really took a hit going into this recession, how should we interpret that statistic?
It's a modest increase, but it is an increase. But we also have to understand that there was kind of a hangover from the credits that ended in April. So what happened is that we sell a lot of home building to try to get product on the market and be able to close it before the credits ran out in mm-hmm. April.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, afterwards, May, June, July, we just saw that hangover, basically, that we've done this. We're not going to build any more houses because everybody pushed forward mm-hmm. their demand for houses a couple of months.
It's the same thing
we saw with the cash for clunkers.
Right.
Sounds like a great idea. Probably wasn't such a bad idea with houses, but at the end of the day, you basically push forward some demand a couple, 3 months, and now we've worked our way through that push forward demand, and so that trough of that coming out of the April, the end of the incentives in April, and so you're going to start to see it pick up. So it's only picked up relative to the trough, but it's not anywhere near where we'd like to see home starts.
And it seems to me that the housing situation is affected by a lot of different things. It's affected by unemployment. It's affected by devaluation of some people's homes and their inability to get out, which is lengthening the time that resales stay on the market. It's being affected by the increasing number of foreclosures that are lowering property values and
well, the foreclosures
problems.
Have really sort of slowed down at this. They're still happening, but the foreclosures we're seeing now are lagging indicators.
Okay.
But the big thing is that what we've done in terms of the sets of regulations for who can qualify for a loan now is we changed that playing field, and now you actually have to be able to pay the loan back in order reasonable expectation in order to get it. It's probably a too conservative level,
mm-hmm.
And we probably need to relax it. But, you know, people respond in exaggerated ways to bad things, and so we've gone from. Remember, we used to joke about these things called ninja loans: no income, no assets, no job, but you could still get
right.
a loan. Well, we've gone full circle on that. We're on the other side of it, where you've got to have a 700 plus credit score and verifiable income, and really have to have a very exact or ability to pay this thing back.
And then doesn't that also affect growth? Doesn't economic growth and the growth of places like Charlotte, which has pretty much stopped growing at the moment because people can't move here. They can't sell their houses in West Virginia or Michigan and come here.
That's right. Or they can't sell their house in Charlotte.
Right.
And to someone as a starter home coming up. And, you know, we've got to find some middle ground in terms of, you know, qualifying for credit. We were probably way too loose in the past. And now we're way too restrictive. Part of it is we don't want banks to be put in a position where we've got to come and rescue them again. So we only want them to have, you know, AAA loans out. But at the same time, as you mentioned, that affects, we've taken a situation where 67-68% of Americans could afford to occupy a single family home,
mm-hmm.
and we've reduced that to probably 60%. And that shift, well, it doesn't seem like that's a big number. That's a whole lot of people who at one point could qualify for homeownership, and today they can't. And it's going to take a long time to work through that difference.
Should homeownership be the American dream? Is that a sustainable thing? Or should we be happy living in an apartment or a rented home?
That's a question that every individual has to make. Now, this interesting history lesson, this concept of this home ownership almost as an American right mm-hmm. came out of the Housing Act in 1950, and that was really a response in some ways to the Great Depression, when capitalism was really under fire and it wasn't clear that capitalism led to greater quality of life for the average individual.
Well, once again, it's not terribly clear that that's what happens, given the disparity of incomes. Have we reached that stage again?
Well, you know, again, you can read those statistics two ways. And, you know, one way you can read them is the gap between the rich and the poor have gotten larger. Uh-huh. I don't think there's any question about that. But at the same time, you know, and real incomes have risen for Americans up until this point where this recession hit, obviously. But real incomes for the lower 20%, the bottom 20%, actually had risen over the decade until the recession began. And so, you know, they are better off. They didn't get better off. They didn't get as better off as the richer got. Mm. But, you know, this is a real issue going forward, and I'm glad you brought this one up. It doesn't really have to do with the recession and the recovery, but this is a real troubling issue going forward. And the question is, you know, what's causing this gap? Why is this occurring? Is it some devious, you know, Oliver Stone plot and conspiracy? Or is it, in fact, just a reflection on productivity levels, or as we like to refer to in economics as human capital? And is the economy structure shifting enough that in order to compete successfully for good-paying jobs, you need higher and higher levels of education and human capital that can be rewarded because those can lead to producing the products that people want? And, you know, that's a real social question that we're going to have to investigate and deal with here as to whether or not the structure of the economy going forward can support not just the top 20%, but the top 20 and the bottom 20 and everyone in between.
Here's another one that we have to analyze, and you're in academia, so let's talk about it for just a second, not a lot of time, but people are now saying, first of all, that college educations have become unaffordable for the average person, that they leave college with astronomical student loans that in many cases, given the job situation, will never be able to be paid back, or you'll be 50 years old when you finally paid off your college loan, which you get out of college at 21 or 22. That's a long time to have to face paying off that loan, and that there has to be a structural change in the way college educations are financed and conducted. Do you agree with that?
To some extent, but I would make a couple of caveats to that. I think that, number one, the evidence up until when the recession began, the evidence clearly suggests that higher education, in fact, pays for itself in terms of lifetime earnings. There's no question. And just what we mentioned earlier, just before this question came up, and that is, you know, why are the rich getting richer? And the rich are getting richer because they have these human capital skills that are in great demand right now. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to get those without going to college. I mean, that's the bottom line. Now, you might not be choosing the right majors. You might be choosing majors that interest you instead of majors that can increase your value to the economy.
In other words, you might want to be an English teacher or study English literature, but you ought to be studying law or medicine or nursing or something.
Engineering or something along those lines. That's one issue. Yeah. But I'd also, you know, caution people. There's no question if you go to a private school and your annual budget for that's $50,000, you know, that's a big ticket. But just, you know, for most of the folks in North Carolina, the North Carolina system, the university system in North Carolina, is still one of the great bargains in the country. And you know, it's not going to cost you anywhere near that to go to a university in North Carolina system school. And I think that there are a number of really high-quality institutions that are incredibly affordable, and you'll be easily able to pay back. Plus, there's a lot of need-based scholarships that are available as well at the UNC system.
When we come back, we're going to talk about the Fed's meeting yesterday. We'll talk about some of your prognostications for the future in the economic forecast and also hear from you, listeners out there. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Beckler Museum of Modern Art, presenting the new exhibition School of Paris, European Abstraction Post-World War II, opening September 10th and featuring more than 60 artworks from the Beckler Collection. Details at beckler.org. And the Blumenthal Performing Arts Center, presenting 9 to 5, The Musical, October 5th through 10th at Ovens Auditorium. Office Buddies Topple Their Boss with a musical score by Dolly Parton. Tickets at 704-372-1000. Salmon that grows twice as fast as conventionally farmed fish could become the first genetically modified animal approved for American consumption. The benefits? and risks. Concerns over how the product might be labeled. Topic of conversation in the 10 o'clock hour of the Diane Rehm Show in about 20 minutes. If you'd like to join our conversation, get on the phone, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or every other way imaginable, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
How would you like to get a call like this?
It's Scott Graff calling from WFAE.
You're joking.
This WFAE listener won a trip back in the spring. You could win one this fall if you pledge early, support the programming, and help us buy back a day of our pledge drive.
Are you serious?
Congratulations.
Are you serious?
For every $40,000 we raise early, our fall pledge drive will be one day shorter. Get more information and make your pledge at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, John Connaughton. Dr. John Connaughton is our guest, the economist who conducts or directs the North Carolina Economic Forecast every quarter. The Fed met yesterday to ponder what action it needed to take or could take to lift the economy out of the doldrums. And after its meeting, it issued a statement expressing, quote, somewhat greater concern about the sluggish pace of economic growth and uncomfortably low inflation. And it said it stood ready to provide additional support to bolster a modest economic recovery. Given how low interest rates are at the moment and some of the things that the Fed does behind the scenes with banks that are practically at zero, the banks are practically being offered money to borrow money at the moment, what else can they do? How many bags of tricks do they have left?
They really have run out of pretty much everything. You know, they can buy long-term treasuries and try to run those rates down, and that's what the speculation is, long-term treasury rates. If they can run those down, then they can run long-term corporate bond rates down, which may entice companies to sell bonds in order to invest, and if they invest, then they will hire people. But I think that's a long shot. I mean, mm-hmm. I really do think that's a long shot in terms of being able to stimulate the economy much.
You know, people, usually we talk about worries about inflation, and they're worrying about uncomfortably low inflation. Why? Yeah. What's to worry? If things cost less, what's to worry?
All right. We just got through talking about the housing market.
Yeah.
Okay. And why is it so anemic? And just give everybody kind of some sense as to how important it is. In the heat of 2000, housing boom,
right?
Residential construction accounted between 5.5, maybe some years as high as 6% of GDP. In a normal year, mm-hmm. okay, without the housing boom, residential construction would account for probably 4.5% of GDP. And now it's down to 3% of GDP. Okay, so that's where your 1.5% is. Why is it that a lot of people aren't buying houses who could afford to buy houses? And the number one reason that I can see is that why buy a house now for $250,000 or $500,000 when it'll be cheaper tomorrow? And that is the number one problem that this concept of deflation mm-hmm. causes. Is, and that's why the Great Depression was so bad. We had 25% deflation. Because what deflation does, whether it's for housing, for cars, for appliances, for an airline ticket, is it causes you to postpone your decision to buy because you don't want to, psychologically or for any number of reasons, you don't want to buy when you suspect that 6 months from now I can buy the same thing for less.
And certainly when you're buying a house, you mm-hmm. don't want to take out a loan for $500,000 on a house when next year the house is worth $4 million.
Exactly. Absolutely.
So that's on a bigger ticket
now,
item.
I don't think they're going to go down that uh-huh. much over the next year. I don't think you're going to see another 20% decline. Uh-huh. But it is possible that you could see another 1-2% decline in housing prices as we work our way through all of these empty foreclosed houses. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it's unrealistic. But that's the thing that's so scary about the prospect of deflation that's got the Fed worried. They don't have any tool for consumer confidence or consumers' desire to hold off buying because they think things are going to be cheaper.
Yeah.
The only thing they can do is to try to pump enough money into the system that they generate some inflation, that they generate just so much. You know, it's kind of like that old line from a Dire Straits song in the 80s, money for nothing. Mm-hmm. They basically pump so much money out into the economy that people just feel a need to go spend it. Interest rates are low. But, right now, home mortgage rates, 30-year fixed are just above 4%, 15-year fixed are below 4%. I mean, it's a phenomenal.
Actually, I was online yesterday, and a thing popped up saying if you qualify, you can get it below 4%.
For 30-year fixed?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
Wow.
Yeah. So there are
it's like 1957 all over again.
Yeah. Well, most of us can't remember back that far. Even if we were here, we don't remember back that far.
I was watching Rob.
But that's why deflation is so serious and so scary to the Fed, and that's what they want to do. I mean, they're concerned for the sluggishness of the economy, but they can live with that. Mm-hmm. What they can't live with, and what scares the out of Ben Bernanke, because he is a scholar who studied the Great Depression,
right,
is around the deflation, because that will just say, as weak as the economy is right now, I'm just going to wait.
We had the management editor of The Economist on the air on Monday, and I know he came to UNC Charlotte to speak to you. And one of the things that he covers in his book, well, some of his many books, is the fact that these new economies, the third world economies, India, China, places like that, one of the reasons that they are experiencing 8% growth a year has to do not only with their burgeoning and upwardly mobile population, but because innovative ideas are coming out of there which are lowering the costs of things, like they're producing $3,000 and $4,000 automobiles. We probably wouldn't want them, but, you know, they run. They're not fancy, but they run. They get you to point A from A to B. And they're inventing machines that we have over here that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars that don't cost even $1,000 over there, and they're perfectly usable machines. Now, won't this lead to deflation, period?
Well, we have experienced deflation in certain sectors of our economy historically. The computers, for example, are a great example. All electronic equipment has experienced tremendous deflation over this decade. Probably prices have been reduced by 50% on average in that segment of the economy. So that's not a problem to have one or two sectors where, through technology and productivity gains, you decrease the costs of those products. It's when it affects the overall economy. Mm-hmm. It affects all products that becomes a problem.
All right.
And that's what we're concerned about.
Put your headphones on. We'll take a call here from Carlisle in Charlotte. Welcome to the program, Carlisle.
Thanks, Mike. First, I'm a little bit surprised by your guest that he did not mention the Bush tax policy of past 8 years as exacerbating the income gap in America, you know, between basically the middle class, richer's gotten richer, and then the census just came back, a huge increase in the poverty level in America. But my question that I called for him was to say, you know, Dems' energy policy would add more to solar and wind. Republicans would try and find more domestic oil and gas. And my question is, which policy would create more jobs in the short term, and which policy would create more jobs for the long run, more lasting jobs? Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, first of all, let me just make one minor correction. Tax policy does not affect the amount of money you earn. It only affects how much you keep. And so this question that whether or not the Bush tax cuts or not resulted in this stratification of income levels is kind of a false assumption. Basically, the tax policy has nothing to do with how much money people make. It has simply to do with how big our deficit is.
Okay.
So and it may be the impact it has on economic growth. But back to this question, I think the obvious answer there is oil and gas exploration will have a greater impact on employment in the short term. Alternative technologies will have a greater impact, potentially long-term, if you pick the alternative energy source right. And that's a real gamble. You know, what is the best? I think we all understand that the current reliance on the way we use energy for mobile sources, not for stationary sources, but for mobile sources, cars, buses, mm-hmm. trucks, et cetera, probably is going to change over the next 20, 30, 40 years. We already start to see some changes taking place, not just because of government regulation, but also because of consumer demand. The question is can you pick out what is going to be the desirable, best-case technology 20, 30, 40 years from now from our current understanding? Mm-hmm. And that's a big gamble. It's a big gamble.
Let's go back to his first question, the Bush tax cuts, because they're scheduled to expire, and there's a big debate going on about this. Those tax cuts allegedly cut tax rates on the richest people in America.
But
the richest people got a lot. We're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars here in tax breaks for the richest people in America. They take that money and they invest it, or they spend it, or they create new businesses which create new jobs. All three of those scenarios, it seems to me, pump money into the economy, which raise all boats. No?
I think theoretically, yes. But I think there are two aspects, and this has not been very well documented or understood in terms of its presentation to the average citizen, either by the politicians or by the media. There are two aspects to the tax cuts. Excuse me. One is the rate that you pay on your income.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Another is the, you know, your normally earned income. The other is the rate on dividends and capital gains. And what you're saying basically is that keeping the rate low on dividends and capital gains encourages investment on the part of all Americans, whether they're lower income, middle income, or higher income.
Right.
And that's certainly something that I would argue. And the evidence is fairly clear that low rates on capital investment are raise all boats and have an economic advantage. It's not so clear that income tax rates on regular income has any effect on economic growth at all. So, you know, one of the things is if you listen to what's being said and the idea of raising the taxes on people making more than $250,000, if you raise their marginal rate on normal income, you're affecting their consumption.
Right.
But you're
not. But doesn't that affect the economy?
It does, but marginally. But if you also raise their rates that they pay on dividends, or they earn from dividends and from capital gains, that affects their decision to make investments. And so what I would argue is that there's probably a middle ground out there, although I'm pretty sure the politicians will never find it, where you keep the rates very low, max 15% on capital gains and dividends for people in those upper brackets, but you go ahead and raise their normal regular income rates.
So should these tax cuts expire? Should they be extended? Should they be adjusted given the current economic reality? What should happen here?
Well, I think this is, again, the short-term, long-term answer. I suspect that there's no economic evidence that suggests that a 39% top marginal rate on ordinary income is going to be problematic in terms of constraining the economy. Certainly on dividends and capital gains, it's disastrous. But even the Obama administration is not, their plan is to max those at 20%. But in the short term, Mike, raising taxes is just not a good idea. It's too risky.
Plus also, it seems to me, taxes on dividends and capital gains, people always think that affects rich people because they're investors. We're all investors. We all have, almost all of us have 401ks.
Yeah, but you don't pay taxes on the 401ks.
Okay, but some of us have investments outside of our 401k that are targeted for retirement. And if Social Security may or may not be here, and pensions may or may not be here, and we're relying more and more on investment in the marketplace, why would they raise taxes on that?
Well, they're not going to on people below 250. I mean, that's their. And just so everybody understands, I mean, I mentioned the rate of 15%. Mm-hmm. That's on people who have marginal ordinary income rates of 25% or greater. But on people who have, a 15 or 10% rate, tax on capital gains and dividends is as low as 5%. So it affected income earned from capital gains and dividends across all income levels and reduce those to try to encourage people to invest more. And, you know, I think that's a good thing. And I think that we actually should start to investigate other types of incentives to get people to invest and save more.
Thank you for your call, Carlisle. To Brad in Statesville we go. Welcome. Brad, go ahead.
John?
Brad, are you...
Very, very interesting.
Well, Brad, you're in a very bad cell. We're not hearing most of what you're saying, so find a good place in the room and don't move and then talk. Try us now.
Oh.
Sorry, it's just not going to work. You're going to have to call us back on the landline. Let me go to Tom in York. Welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning. You know, just a thought. Have we as a country priced ourselves out of existence? I mean, how are we going to get all these jobs back or created when we're competing against highly educated workforces who work for less, where the students and the young people have been literally hungry for years, and they are driven to succeed. And I don't know that anything is going to change until we Americans stop fighting about all these social issues and become as hungry to succeed as the rest of the world is, and put our noses to the grindstone and start doing things and stop fighting?
Well, he brings up a good point.
Oh, it's a great question.
But we are the most productive society in the world, aren't we?
Absolutely. But
so
let me. He's got really two mm-hmm. streams of thought there. One I want to. One thought is the idea that there's a kind of what we call economics, a wages fund. That there's just so much potential output out there, and the pie is so big. And if somebody else, like India and China, get a bigger share, then by definition, we're going to get a smaller one. And I would argue that that's not necessarily the case. That we can make a bigger pie globally. Mm-hmm. China and India can get bigger slices. And we can get a bigger slice too, as well.
Maybe not bigger as fast as theirs,
but it will still get bigger. So that's one issue. Okay. So don't get concerned that there's a fixed amount out there. And if China and India get more, we can't get more. We can get more. That's number one. Number two is the idea that, you know, we've got to get leaner, meaner, hungrier. And there's probably some truth to that. I think that, you know, there's a fine line in terms of how much safety net you can have.
Does this recession
becomes
help?
Disincentive.
Does this recession help that?
I think it does.
I mean, prior to this recession, and this is old people talking about young people now. Yeah. People would say, look at young people, high school, college people, and think they want to graduate from college and go right to the presidency of the company and make $200,000 a year. They feel entitled to that. They don't want to do anything any of the steps in between. That may not be true, but that was the perception on part of a lot of people. Doesn't this give them a reality check?
Well, I think young people that does a disservice, I think, to young people, that idea. I mean, I deal with them all the time in School of Business at UNC Charlotte, and I think they're very realistic and they have very, very moderate demands on society and the business world.
I've got 30 seconds. We never talked about your prognostications. We simply ran out of time. Are you optimistic? Are we coming out of this? When is Charlotte going to feel the effects of the upside of this?
I'm hoping that 2011 will be a better year than the second half of 2010. I think that we'll probably see 2.5% growth in 2011, and we'll start to whittle away at the unemployment rate a little bit in 2011.
And the national unemployment rate's 9.6%. Ours is higher. Why? Very quickly.
We got hammered harder because of the financial sector meltdown.
Okay. That's it. We have no more time. Dr. John Connaughton, Director of the North Carolina Economic Forecast. Thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Mike.
Charlotte Talks with